You're listening to Sikhism 101 by Imran Daniel. Imran is the Director of Multicultural Engagement at Northview Community Church. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 8, 2014 at Northview Community Church.
You all have the handouts. I put like some of the basic information out there so that you guys can take it home and use it later on. First thing we need to know about like when Sikhism was started. Now there are two things about Sikhism. So when we talk about like Sikhism, Guru Nanak, who's the founder of Sikhism, he was the one who basically came up with this whole idea of Sikhism, whereas the Guru Gobind Singh, he's the 10th Guru, who came up with the idea to start it as a religion. So Guru Nanak, just the movement, because when he saw that majority of the people are Hindus, and he saw like Hindus were and Muslims were persecuting these Sikh people, his whole idea was to create equality and social justice for those who are going through these trials. Sikhism comes from Hinduism. In Hinduism, they have like tons of gods. In Sikhism, they believe only in one God. Now, again, like this definition would be different whoever you ask, because most of the Sikh people may not know everything about Sikhism, right? So they will have different definitions about all those. But before that, there are 10 gurus in Sikh religion. Guru Nanak was the first one, and Guru Gobind Singh was the last one. As I said, Guru Nanak started the movement in 1500, and Guru Gobind Singh, he came up with the idea of religion around 1620. The word Sikh can be translated as a disciple or learner. It was originated in Punjab, India, back in 15. Guru can be translated as a teacher, but not as a god. Because often people would say like, so if they have 10 gurus, do this mean that they worship these 10 gods? No, it's not like that. Gurus are supposed to be basically a person who would show them how to connect with God, how to walk on this road. So that's the whole definition about that. Now, Guru Nanak, who's the founder of Sikhism, he's now worshipped as God, even though he's founder. So people often think like, so the Guru Nanak is God then? No, it's not. Even Guru Nanak, who's the founder of that, his whole desire was to know God deeply and have that one-on-one relationship with God. Whole idea of Sikhism was to kind of know God deeply, meditate on His word, reflect upon who He is, and reflect on the universe that we live in, and all that. Guru Nanak, if we look into the prayer that he said in Guru Granth Sahib, Guru Granth Sahib is one of their holy books, which I'll get back about that in a second. But this is his prayer, Guru Nanak's prayer, who's the founder. He says, like, praying to God, talking about like you everything. So this is what he says: I cannot live for a moment without thee. I'm miserable without my beloved. I have no friend. When I have thee, I have everything. I hunger and thirst for a sight of thee. Now this sounds utterly Christian, right? Because this is what we as a Christian desire to do that too. This was his whole desire to know God deeply and become one with God. Because when you ask them, how do you define God? They're like different definitions, as I said. One of the definitions would be one supreme, impersonal, true God who is just and gracious, but beyond knowing or comprehending, though he dwells everywhere, including within our own being. Another definition is, God is the same God for all people of all religions. This is someone who doesn't know much about Sikhism because they're just kind of like trying to come up with some sort of definition, right? So further, they would say God is the creator, sustainer, and destroyer. So but he's still not impersonal God. This is why like Guru Nanak, his desire was like, I want to know that God face to face. I want to connect with him. I want to become one with him. So now, 10 gurus. There are 10 gurus. First guru, Nanak, which you have there in your sheet. Last guru, Gobind Singh, who started the whole movement there to Sikh as a religion. But this is where it stops. So 1 to 10. The last guru is called Guru Granth Sahib Ji, which is, I think, in your handouts as well, which is their holy book. Now, when all this Guru Gobind Singh, when he was the guru, he decided that we shouldn't have any more human gurus, because otherwise, if we have all these gurus, then there's no difference between us and Hinduism, because they have millions of gods. Therefore, if we just kind of like from 1500 onwards, we have all these gurus, we'll have millions of gurus, and then people will be confused who to worship, right? Therefore, it's good idea that's what his thought was. It's good to kind of collect all the writings of all the previous gurus, put them together, and create one book, which is called Guru Granth Sahib Ji, which is in the temples, or they can have it at homes as well. Now, Guru Granth Sahib, the holy book, is treated as a person. It's not treated as a book. When you go to the temple, you'll see the book is sitting on a bed, and there's one person at least all the time sitting beside it, and just like have a hand fan and making sure nothing sits on it, because it's they're treating it as a person. Same thing, they put the book to bed at 10 o'clock, around 10 o'clock p.m., and then bring it back in the morning. So it's like person's going to bed, person's getting up. That's the whole idea. And the room, if you go where the put that holy book, it's just probably expensive room to kind of create all that. They have air conditioning in the room and all that. It's just doesn't make sense when you like, so you're treating your book like that. But to them, it's important. It's a holy book, right? Whereas for us, we have our Bible, we just throw it in our feet. No respect at all. So probably something that we can learn from them, that this is our holy book. Hey, we need to pay respect to this book, because this is the book that gives us instructions to live our lives, right? Always encourage people, especially if you have Sikh people or any Sikh, Muslim, Hindu, anyone like that, come to your house and your Bible is sitting on the floor. Not a good idea. They won't consider you a good Christian, because they think like you don't. If you cannot respect your book, you cannot respect your God. Simple, right? Because how can you say that like I can leave my book in my feet and then like still I can become one with God or I know God? So just respect is a huge, huge thing. At home, my wife and I, we often go through this kind of moment where we lead a Bible study at our home on Monday night, and people come, and I always have my Bible on my couch because I grew up with that, right? I won't put my Bible on the floor. People would come and they would leave their Bibles on the floor. Initially it bothered me, so I told them like, hey, this is, I don't do that. Can you just put your Bible either in your lap or on the couch or somewhere, but don't leave it in your feet? Didn't care. Right? It doesn't bother me now, but initially it was a shock for me to see when I first came to North America. I saw people like, there's the Bible in the feet, or like one pastor was preaching, as soon as he finished preaching, threw his Bible like that. Okay, let's pray. And I'm like, what? You just threw the Bible and now praying? Like, how does this work? So anyway, just this was a side note, that keep that in mind. If you're treating with the Sikh people, try to show respect to the holy book. As I said, like they treat it as a person. Now, some of the other things, some of the common practices, daily prayers, they have three pillars of Sikhism. First one is to remember God at all times. Second one is to live your life honestly. And the third one is sharing what you have with those who don't have much. Now, this sounds very Christian. We will be basically covering some of the similarities as I go on, but like there was at the end, I think I'll just kind of like make sure that we go through them specifically as well. The other thing is means of salvation. For us, it's a different, like when someone asks like, so how do you achieve your salvation, or how do you become Christian, or how are you saved? We will answer differently than they would. Their definition of salvation is worship God, do good deeds in the name of God, performing services for community, and fighting the five evils. Now, five evils are greed, ego, attachment to the things of this world, anger, and lust. So this is how they would achieve salvation. Like, it's based on my performance. If I do good deeds, I can get to heaven, or I can become one with God. But if I don't do good deeds, then I'll go to hell, or I'll just go through the cycle basically until I become a better person. Then eventually I will emerge with God to become one with God. So it's just an ongoing cycle. They call it, I think, 8.4 million times you have to kind of go through the cycle. If you ask them about Jesus, who is Jesus, they would say Jesus is a saint, not son of God. This is a difference between us and them. They would still respect Jesus as a prophet, as a son of God, according to what we believe. But to them, they would argue like, okay, how can God have a son? Right? He's impersonal God, but if he is a son, then he's not God, because he's just like one of us, like human person, like he's like in a human shape or form. Some of the common names for God in Sikh or in Punjabi language they have is Waheguru Ji. I think I have it on the sheets. Or Ik Onkar, which means there's only one God, or Satnam, true is his name. But the most common name that is used out there is Waheguru Ji. Every time Sikhs are trying to buy a house or a car or something, or applying for a job, you would probably hear that, like something like Waheguru Ji. Waheguru Ji ki khalsa, Waheguru Ji ki fatah. So just kind of like remembering God. Okay, God, I'm submitting this to you. You're the true God, and you're the one God. Help me to get through this, or help me to make a wise choice or wise decision. When you see a Sikh person, how do you identify that this person is a Sikh, not a Hindu or a Muslim? What are some of the common things that you would look for? Turban, yeah?
This is an outfit.
sure, yeah, exactly. But in India, they're like, yeah, they're not Sikh people, eh? But I mean, like, they're easy to identify, because like they wear five keys, which that's what they call. They have like turban is number one. I'll go by like long kesh, kanga, kada, kacha, kirpan. Now in English, it'd be long hair, comb, steel bracelet, underwear, and sword. I think you have it on your sheet, right? On your sheet, and the symbolics or the meanings behind that as well. So basically, like, hair is considered a gift from God. Therefore, they should not cut hair on their body, because it's just a gift from God. Sword signifies the duty of Sikhs to stand against injustice. As I said, like, initially, when there was a caste system in Hinduism, when they saw that like people are treating those who are less fortunate, that they cannot drink from the same cup, they cannot have the same job as others, and they cannot eat this maybe in the same room as those who are in a higher place. Therefore, they needed to kind of stand against the evil and injustice that was happening back in the day. That's where the whole thing started, which ended up becoming a religion. Now, if you ask them about the concept of heaven and hell, you'll get completely different definitions again. But before I jump into that, let me just say this. The most of the Sikh people themselves, they would not know much about Sikhism. You probably would know more about Sikhism than they know. But not all of them. Most of them will not know. Because religion and culture is so tied together, you don't know whether it's a religious thing or whether it's a cultural thing. You're just kind of following the way you brought up at home. Therefore, different definition, different ideas, different concept of different things that they do. So when you ask like heaven is known as Sachkhand in Punjabi, which is salvation is received when Sikhs is united with God by doing good deeds. Can I get some water? Thank you. So again, like the concept of salvation and going to heaven is through good deeds. If you do well, then you go to heaven. But again, most people may not understand the idea of like if there's a heaven. They probably would like, I don't know. Or maybe there's a heaven. Because to them, like you just go through the cycle of lies. If you were a good person, you will become a better person next time when you're in this world. If you were bad, then you come as an animal or some other form. Therefore, they have to kind of work hard in order to achieve or become one with God. Do they all do that? Probably not, right? Which we'll probably get into that when we have the Q&A time. Concept of hell is a mixed matter in Sikhism. Mainstream Sikh believers believe that hell is the cycle of rebirth and over again, as I just explained, unless finally reaches with God. Whereas the other ones would say that hell is a real place. If you're a bad person, then you will go to hell and God will judge you. So again, like there are different definitions. They themselves don't know much about that. But is it important to know for us? Probably yes, in order to kind of like connect with them. Now, I would encourage when you have the opportunity to talk to them, use the language that they're familiar with, because if we are throwing a language that's familiar to us and not to them, you're not going to get anywhere, which we'll probably get into that in a second. Now, some of the common similarities are they believe in one God, we believe in one God. Again, the definitions will be different. I asked one of our ESL students, we have ESL classes here at North 3 every Sunday. So this one uncle, I asked him, picked him up from the temple and asked him, like, who is God? And he's like, oh, everything is God. Even this chair can become a God for me, or this tree can be a God for me. See, so the different definitions from different people because they don't know much about that. I tried to explain, he didn't understand anything, even though I was speaking in Punjabi with him, but still, they were raised in a Sikh home. They don't know any of the background or any of the history or maybe how this whole thing works. So just to kind of know that, like, at least we have the common ground, they believe in one God. Guru Nanak's desire again was to become one with God. Here are two other prayers that I will quote here. When he's trying to reach out to God, this is what he asks him, like, I'm a sinner, thou alone art pure. As the waters cover the sea, so are my sins in number. Give me thy grace, have pity that I sink not as a stone into the depths of the sea. Right? So he's crying out to know God, like, hey, I'm a sinner, I need your grace. This is the first time you probably hear grace from him, or in Sikhism, like, the concept of grace is not talked much about that. It's basically all based on the performance, how well you do in the life that you've given. Another time he talks about or asks God, the Lord is kind, merciful, and compassionate. All are satiated and satisfied through him. Now, we'll find this in Psalm 145, verse 8, right? It's a very similar idea. These are like the prayers that we see in the Guru Granth Sahib, we will notice that, like, it may sound like they borrowed some from Christians, some from Muslims, some from Hinduism, from bits from here and there. It's not like complete story or complete verse or chapter where you would like, oh, so it started here and then it ends here. It's not like that. Another similarity is sin is considered a bad thing, especially against another man. For example, lust, anger, greed, attachment to the things of this world, as I mentioned. Love, give to those who don't have much, which reminds us of the parables when Jesus talks to the disciples like, hey, I was hungry, you didn't feed me, or I was naked, right? So the same idea, like, help those who don't have any of this. Another thing is to remember that meet where they are, which means, remember when Paul went to Athens in Acts chapter 17, he's walking around and he sees this sign, unknown God. Now, did Paul go and attack those people and ask them, like, okay, hey, the God you're worshiping is not true God, right? His approach was totally different. He's like, let's talk about this unknown God that you're talking about. I think we need to do the same thing too. Let's talk about what you understand or what you know and go from there rather than what I know and you don't, because then it's not going to go anywhere. Excuse me. I think that that's the best way to share the gospel too with them, meeting them where they are and using the language that they're familiar with. Because often what happens is that we use the language that we are familiar with and they are not, then we lose them and they have no idea how to answer that, even if they know the answer as well. For example, I was talking to one of my friends a couple of years ago. He grew up here. He asked me, like, okay, so what do you guys do in your small group or Bible study groups? I told him, like, we read the Bible, we study the Bible together, and then we have fellowship. What's fellowship? Right? He had no idea about fellowship. It's, for us, like, it's Christian language, right? Or grace, or this, or that. All these words. I think it's important to kind of tone down our language and use what they're familiar with. Just know what they're talking about and just go from there. Most of the Hindu, Sikh, or Muslim people come to know Jesus through dreams and visions and through stories. They hear stories, they see Christ through dreams, and then accept him as their Lord and Savior. Sadhu Sundar Singh, one of the Indian evangelists back in the late 1800s, he was born as a Sikh, became Christian at the age of 16, and his life was transformed. He met Christ through a vision at night when his mom was passed away, and he was just trying to search for peace to kind of fill that gap, and God was the only one who could do that. And he asked God, if you truly reveal yourself to me, if not, then I'm going to commit suicide, I'm going to die. At 4 in the morning, God reveals himself to him, and there he was. He runs to his father and tells him, like, hey, I'm a Christian now. I just met God. And his dad was like, you're crazy, just go back to bed, right? Because he's a devoted Sikh too. But, I mean, this is how they come to know Christ as well, through stories, through dreams and vision. So stories are powerful to connect with. Some things to remember when you're connecting with a Sikh person are, how are we doing with the time? Develop a meaningful ongoing relationship. Because if we just think like, okay, I'll meet this person once and then I'm done with that person, it's not going to go anywhere. Then the first meeting, whatever you talk to that person, is just useless. Because you need to develop the ongoing relationship in order to get to know the person, in order to earn his or her trust, in order to share the gospel. Ask them questions. Often, I think what I find, the two things what people do when sharing the gospel or trying to reach out the Christian people, the Sikh people, A, they just kind of talk right away about Jesus, like, hey, Jesus is Son of God, and if you accept him, you'll go to heaven. If you don't, then you'll go to hell. And they will be like, I don't care then. All I'm trying to do is I'm trying to do good deeds in order to become one with God, right? Wrong approach, according to at least my experience. Unless they ask you a question, different story, but try to build friendship, get to know the person, earn their trust, and then introduce Christ through stories and all that. Second thing, hospitality is a key in the culture there. My wife and I, we went to one of our ESL students' house for dinner last Saturday. We were there like for 4.5 hours, right? We loved it. My wife can't speak Punjabi that much. She's standing right there. But it was just like, I was translating back and forth, right? A bit here and there. But it was a great time. Whereas here, we go by the clock and we're like, okay, if I'm done, like, I have half an hour or 15 minutes to meet this person and then I'm going to can establish that relationship. I don't think so, right? Especially with these people, because you can spend like at least a couple hours easily on a cup of tea. So, just a side note on that, like, make sure when you're trying to reach out to a sick person, have at least an hour or two in order to connect with them. Ask them tons of questions. If you're telling them or you're telling me about yourself, I'm not interested, right? But if I want to get to know you, I'm not going to talk about myself. I'm going to ask you questions. When did you come to Canada? What did you do? What were the challenges, right? Was it easy to come to Canada? Like all sort of questions. Or why do you go to the temple? What do you do there? That will tell them like, okay, this person is interested in me. Therefore, I need to kind of like connect with this person and tell him the answers. Last thing, Sadhu Sundar Singh, when he saw that Western missionaries back in the day when they were in India and they were trying to reach out to Punjabi or Sikh people or Indian people with the gospel message, their approach was completely different. It was just like, tell them the four spiritual laws, hey, this is what you need to do in order to get to heaven or in order to follow Christ. Did not work. And when he sees that happening, he saw this one British guy giving a glass of water to this Indian guy when he was he fall, and this Indian guy rejected the glass of water because he knew by giving me a glass of water he will ask me to come to the church or become a Christian and all that. He knew the purpose behind that. And when Sundar saw that, he's like, hey guys, you need to stop that. This is not a good approach, because they know you now, because you've been doing that for years now. Try something different. And this is what he tells them. This is why I'm always telling my Christian friends, we are offering Christianity in a Western cup and India rejects it. But when we offer the water of life in an Eastern bowl, then our people will recognize it and take it gladly. Now, what does he mean by offering the water in an Eastern bowl? Tell stories. Connect with them, spend time with them, get to know them. It's not like, hey, here's four spiritual laws, here's a ticket to go to heaven, have fun, right? Not going to fly that way with them anymore. It's just like hospitality, family-oriented, community-oriented people. Therefore, we need to kind of connect with them where they are at. I understand that we go by the clock, but they don't, right? To them, it's like, oh, well, if it's 7 o'clock meeting, I'll get there like 7:45 or 8 o'clock. It's normal, right? For us, it's like different. And the last thing I would just encourage you is to tell stories. Remember Jesus, when he was speaking to the crowds, Jesus would use parables and he would ask good questions. We all have stories. Our stories have become our testimonies. And our testimony can change the lives who we interact with. Therefore, I think with the Indian people, we can do that too. They love stories. I remember one time I was sharing my testimony at the basketball camp at Harry Sears School. And I was sharing my stories. And as I was sharing, some of the parents who were listening to that, their eyes were open and you could hear some of the like, wow. It was just like that. Because they were able to connect with those stories. They've been there. They went through those kind of moments where they're like, okay, how do I kind of gain peace? What do I do in order to kind of solve this problem or this situation or that situation, right? Tell stories and ask good questions. Amen? It's time for Q&A. I have Laura, a good friend of mine. We work together here at Northview. She will come up and help me answer some of the questions from her perspective, like how she interacts with some of the Punjabi speakers who come to our ESL classes. Yes, and then
Yes. I have a question. You say the Sikhs pledge to wear the five articles of faith. This obviously refers to men. Or am I wrong?
Some women wear turbans too, and some wear... men and women both can wear the five articles. We have one of our students, she went through this process called Khalsa, which is a baptism, and now she wears all five articles. Right?
Yeah, but generally...
Not as many women probably wear this. It looks like a handkerchief or scarf.
Yes, I've seen them.
And I think it means that it expresses a sincere devotion, or maybe they're a little more devout than other Sikhs if they go through the process of being baptized. And in the same way, not all Christians take their faith really seriously, and lots of people call themselves Christians. And then there's different levels of devotion. I think it's the same with the Sikhs. Some are more... really serious about it, and some
of
you not quite so serious
about it. And Guru Gobind Singh, who was the last 10th guru, he was the one, he started this Khalsa. And basically, when someone is ready, Khalsa means pure, when he or she is ready to live up to the expectations of Guru Gobind Singh. So that's why you need to wear all these five articles of faith, that you're ready to commit your life to to Sikh religion now. You were second, sorry.
Yeah. As a Caucasian, as opposed to being a Punjabi, what is our limits to what we can expect in terms of interacting with Sikhs? Obviously, if you've got an old man that's just emigrated in and doesn't speak one word of English, that shuts us down right there. But in terms of even second generation, third generation, What's our roles for each of those generations in terms of interacting and how much they receive us? Because, of course, we're perceived as... because it's an ethnocentric religion, right? There's not very few people convert into Sikhism. It does happen through marriage. But what is our role with the different generations? And what's the keys of the kingdom?
Well, I find that in interacting with Sikh people, I find them very easy to become friends with. And they're very interested in friendships and very friendly and very kind. So I found that really easy. And I think there is a big difference between the generations. And so I think that the first generation Indo-Canadians are usually a little more devoted to Sikhism. And then second and third generation Indo-Canadians probably make less and less so. There have been some studies that show that that's kind of a trend. And so third and fourth generation Indo-Canadians are becoming quite secular and quite Western. And so, we might share the gospel with them in the same way that we would with anybody else.
Good, because they will not know anything about Sikhism at all. They will just go to the temple even to please their parents, because they ask them, hey, we need to go to the temple. I asked one of my friends, how often do you go to the temple? And he's like, whenever I feel the urge to go. So you don't have to go if you don't want to. So...
comment to that. I work at the hospital, and I find the first generation, even learning, you can see up there, it's a Sastri Kalji, even attempting to learn their language, they find quite respectful. And I find that even the little Punjabi that I do know, it completely changes things. I can say a couple words. Sometimes they start blubbering in Punjabi quite fast, but the older generation, they really respond well to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I just wrote this greeting. This is Satsri Kalji. This is the greetings. Now, every time you just greet them in the traditional to the first generation, you'll get a smile from them. Even they will respond back to you with either the head nod or respond back Satsri Kalji, or do this. Satsri Kalji, they did different ways. I think it's a good way to start at least to greet them in their traditional language. Second generation, they speak English. You don't need to worry about that. It's easy to connect with them.
But how do we not get caught in the middle of the generational gap? Because if they see that we're friends with somebody who's younger, like their kids who have been educated in Canada, speak good English, are changing and leaving the old ways, how do we not be perceived as that contributing to that or to be the enemy?
As a Christians? Well, they are
first generation.
They are aware of that. As soon as you come to Canada, they know that Let me give you an example. I went to this printing shop for our flyers about our English classes. The first time I went to that shop, he's a first generation guy, and he asked me, so are they going to convert people there? Like, you're trying to bring them to church to learn English, are they going to convert there? Like, that was his idea. So he knows, like, people, we have this reputation that we do that. We're not going to hide it, right? That's our ultimate goal. But then second generation, they're open to that. They're not going to the temple to go through all this ceremonial or any of the traditional things that their parents went through. They won't even take part into the parades that they have. They'll come for fun, for socialize, but not just for any of the religious beliefs or anything like that. Or they will go to get free food. I think there was one person in there after.
Can I fire you three quick questions?
Sure.
One, food sensitivities. If we're inviting people over to try to engage in that cultural relationship stuff, are there things that we should be careful about? Like with a Hindu friend, I'm not going to serve beef, you know, but I don't know much in terms of Sikhism and whether there are sensitivities that we should have there.
Yeah, most of them won't eat meat. Although they do eat some chicken or lamb or goat, beef is not, because they were never raised up that way. Some those who are baptized Sikhs, devoted Sikhs, they will not even eat eggs or anything like that.
Strictly vegan.
Exactly. Anything that has eggs, they will not eat it. It's good to ask when you're inviting someone, like, hey, can I use eggs in the food, or will you eat something if I make this? It's totally fine to ask them.
Second question was, when people are going to the temple, you're saying that our peers in the Sikh community who we work with and engage with from time to time have no idea about Sikhism. So when you go to the temple, what happens? Do you walk in, stand around, and walk out? Or like, are they being taught? Is there somebody teaching or preaching? Or what is actually the process of what happens in the temple? Is it like our church services, or what takes place?
Do you want to go on that, and then I'll go after?
Sure. Yeah. So I think that they do receive teaching while they're at the temple, and I think that one difference between Sikhism and Christianity is that they're not as familiar with their holy book as Christians usually are, and so they only have small portions of their scriptures at home sometimes, and they have to be treated with such respect that, you know, most Sikh people are not really familiar with it. So that's one difference as to why they... And they do have teaching times at their temples, because I know that some of our students will say that some of the teaching is even in English now, so that the younger generations can understand it. But why they don't understand, I think maybe it's just that we really value and cherish studying the Word of God, and that's probably not true.
So no, when they go to the temple, basically, so you cover your head as a man and woman too. So you go to the main floor where there's food and all that, but then if you want to go worship or bow before the holy book, you go to second floor, take your shoes off, and then you enter to the temple. Now, most people, those who are Sikh people, they will go walk there and bow before the holy book. And then on the right side, there's a guy sitting with some sweet called prasad. Basically, it's kind of like communion. So that you bow before the book and then go on the side to get some of the communion, come back, sit at your place, and you eat that. Just very, very traditional. And then you can sit there for like 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, totally up to you, quietly, while the guys, the priests up there, they're singing hymns from the holy book, Guru Granth Sahib, with the harmonium and all the tabla, with all the instruments. Some people don't understand anything. They're just there to show respect and sitting there. And then you leave, come downstairs, get some food, and you're done.
So it's a lot of fellowship. They just don't use the word fellowship.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can I add something to that? I was just talking to Ezra Cody the other day, and I guess one of the Sikh leaders in Abbotsford approached a doctor from Northview and was asking him, how is it that we train our youth so well? They realize that, you know, second and third and fourth generation of the Canadians are not learning much or that much about Sikhism, and they're actually, you know, even approaching people in the Christian community about how are we doing it. So I think they recognize it.
The final question was, I learned something here about, I presume that Sikhs had a similar position as us too. You are born, you live, you die, there's one God, and, you know, heaven, hell thing. If reincarnation is the their reality that they believe in, where where does origins come from? Where do ends come from? Are there the same 10 billion souls who keep cycling through human and animal forms and whatnot? Do you have new souls coming into existence? You know, heaven, hell, like when you end up there, what's the process? Like, is there prescribed doctrine on that, or is it just a vague
sense? No, I mean, there probably will be some experts who can explain, but then it may not make sense again. Mm-hmm. Most of the people don't know anything. It's just this is how they're raised. As I said early on, I think their culture and religion, they're so tied together that you don't know even yourself what you're doing is religious or is it a cultural thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just like ongoing process. I believe it ends at after 8.4 million times. You keep going until you become a better person. I don't know, man. Some may be halfway through.
I can answer that for you later if you want to talk to me. There's a website called Search Gurbani. Go to it and you can download the Gurbani Sats yourself. All right, it's a good program. I met the guy from San Francisco who put it together. And it's in the original Gurmukhi script with his English transliteration plus a translation.
Okay. It's called Search what?
Search Gurbani, G-U-R-B-A-N-I.
Yeah.
And I got it on my computer here. I have an 8-volume set too, but here you can get it free and see it and play with it. But so that's one thing I mentioned. The other thing is that by defining Kelsa, means pure ones, right? And Kelsa may be used in the Gurgaon itself for the word, means pure ones. Mm-hmm. But nothing of Kelsa, of the organization, is in their scriptures, the Gurgaon itself. Guru Gobind Singh founded Kelsa, which is Vaisakhi Parade's all about, right? Mm-hmm. But that he founded that in 1699 as a religious army or militia to fight the Mughals, Muslim Mughals, who were killing Hindus and Sikhs. All right. And
So
you got to make that distinction. All right. And Amrit is a baptism into that organization. The 5Ks, the turban's not one of them. That's an additional one, right? But none of Gobind Singh's writings is in the Guru Granth Sahib. Only the 6 gurus, 1 to 5, and Guru Gobind Singh's father, who was the 9th guru. So you got to be understand that difference. So, and the Sikhs don't know the Guru Granth Sahib. The Granthis aren't really teaching it.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's so many things here. As far as reincarnation, it's taught in the scriptures. It's Hindu concept, all right? And so on. So all of the Hindu concept, 8.4 million incarnations is 84 lakhs. Yeah. In the original, lakhs 100,000. And really what it means, it's transmigration of souls to become into trees, even a snake, a rat, a rock even, which is inanimate, it's kind of crazy, before becoming human again, to try to make it right, to become a Gurmukh, and then become one with God in Nirvana.
Yeah. Right. Well, see, as I said, like, you probably would know more than they would, right? But can you use this language with them when you're trying to reach out to
their own scriptures?
Right, exactly.
The Bible's mentioned, all right? It's called the Kitab. It's spoken in the Quran, but it's also in the Gurgat itself about 15 times. And reincarnation is mentioned, well, it talks about millions and countless incarnations, and then the 84 lakhs is mentioned 19 times. So I've studied this, okay? So you get into it. But Nirvana is the concept.
Yeah.
Heaven and hell is spoken there, mainly by Kabir, the Bhakti. And he mentions Baba Adam on page 1161, and he talks about heaven and hell throughout the scriptures, but then he denies it on page 969. Anyways, that's a long discussion.
Yeah, Jerry's been studying Sikhism for 13 years. I spoke with him on the phone 2 days ago, I believe. He knows more than most of the Sikh people would know. But again, my point is, we know all this. Can you share all this with them when you're talking to them? Absolutely, or maybe not. That's my main point is, use the language that they're familiar with. Use your stories. Be culturally sensitive and all that. Yes, we have all these doctrinal, theological, or all these points. We can use them, but they have no idea what grace is even, right? because the English word they're not familiar with. So anyway, last question, and then I think our time's up. Yes.
I admire the Sikh community. One of the things I admire, I'll see groups of men, usually older men, sitting and they're talking. Several times I've gone and sat amongst them and given them a greeting. I got this great and I've written it down. I've tried to get out of them.
It's
a very positive thing, especially about men. Most of us guys don't talk to each other. What are they talking about? Punjabi is not one of my languages. I'm not getting much out of it. I appreciate their social. They're very social people.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious. Where am I going wrong, or am I going wrong at all?
So, was it a question or? So your question is like, when they're sitting, what they're talking about?
What are they talking about?
But all they're doing playing cards.
Yeah, they're not playing cards when they're out. Sometimes I sat with them down at the center down here, and they're playing cards. But they're sitting on the side of the street. Is it just things about their families? Is it about Sikh, or what? Where are they at?
They're talking about families. They're talking about the culture. They're talking about, like, they came to Canada, how their life is different. Now, I went there to the Clarebrook Park with one of my friends last year. I sat amongst them. I played cards with them for about like week and a half. I'll go like once or twice a week just to kind of connect with them, because I speak the language. My other friend, he's like a Caucasian white guy, and like he would just laugh whenever they're laughing. He had no idea for translation here and there, but it was all about families, cultures, and like what they're observing, different things. Like if a person's walking with their dog, they're like, oh, so it's funny how they look after their dogs much better than their kids. Like, just giving you an example, like they're observing and talking about everything. It's not, they're not talking about their beliefs or anything like that.
And I think it's really great, like these questions, I think it's a great thing to go and sit with them and be friends.
I'm not stepping out of bounds.
No, I think that's totally great.
Yeah, it is totally fine. Yeah. In fact, like they would love to interact with someone who speaks English and doesn't speak Punjabi, because then they, like, when I first went there and I was translating my other friend, this one guy said, like, oh, at least we can learn some English with these guys if they come every day. Because they love to kind of, like, interact with those who are not from their own community. The only thing, they cannot talk to you guys, because they think, like, okay, I don't speak English. If I try to open my mouth, it'd be embarrassing because I cannot say more than one word or something like that, right?
Therefore, some of them,
right, but there's that fear. So if you take the initiative to greet them or talk to them, they'll be smiling and like talking to you. Everything.
Why is it just, you know, I don't see that trait amongst younger guys.
I think they're working. I think they're working,
none of the old guys work.
They're retired.
Yeah. Culturally, the way it works, parents, when they had their kids, it was their job to look after their children, right? They will provide for them. It's different here in Canada. Now we're speaking culturally. Forgive me if it will come across negatively or in any way that would offend you. Don't mean to. But there, when you're young, when you parent, your parents' job is to provide for your education. You lived in the house till you get married and all that. You don't have to pay rent. It's just doesn't work that way. Whereas here, you, as soon as you're 18, you have to pay rent or you move out of the house, like slightly different, I guess, culture, which is fine, works here. But when they come here, it's children's job to look after their parents when they're older. So hey, you look after me when I was young, now you're old, it's my turn to look after you. Can it make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that is also changing in second, third generation. People, like even for example, sorry, I'm in healthcare. Some older, younger generation, they'll put their loved ones in care homes. That's kind of starting to kind of happen a little bit more than maybe before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, our time's up. Thank you for your questions and listening to me, and have a great day.